Well, thank you very much, first of all, for having invited me, Professor Koltay. It's really a big pleasure for me to have the opportunity to present here in Budapest. And I, of course, also would like to thank you that I could contribute a chapter to the book. However, at the same token, I may say that I'm going to present another topic than my contribution in the book. I would like to look today into a couple of issues related to the need to change the media governance framework due to the technological developments. In order to be brief in the first part of my presentation, I would only like to mention a couple of elements of the new media landscape. Very obviously, media play a central role in modern societies, and media are directly interrelated with politics. On the one hand, media want to assess political life. On the other hand, political bodies regularly have a substantial interest in the information-driven processes. Now, the new technologies, of which you are very familiar, I'm sure, and the globalization of communications have increased the difficulty to safeguard a national media regime. And as far as media is concerned, we still are dominantly governed by national systems. And somehow these tensions need to be overcome. A certain harmonization of the cross-border rulemaking appears to become inevitable. My first element is called from one-way communication to interactive communication. In the past, communication took place between a sender and a receiver, or maybe a few receivers. Later on, this scheme has been enlarged by the idea of mass production and mass distribution, for example, by cinema, radio, television. Nevertheless, this sort of communication takes place in a one-way direction between a source and a large number of receivers, being classed as one-to-many communication. New technological developments have changed this situation in the meantime, particularly due to the internet. Practically everybody can communicate with everybody. We do have two-way channels with the digital networks. We could also see the internet as an international online data bank, allowing the sharing of linked multimedia documents. In other words, civil society has gradually started to replace traditional face-to-face communication by using the new technologies. Second element, from contents produced for many to individual contents. Internet also allows to produce and distribute contents without the support of any kind of intermediaries, of gatekeepers, etc. In other words, individuals are able to upload certain contents. They don't have to go to media, to publishing houses, or to television stations. This has already been mentioned in the very first presentation. And thereby, the volume of contents is of course enlarged very much, and tailor-made contents can be made available to the public through the new communication channels. And finally, the third element concerns the fact that we are moving from short, relatively short living information to always traceable information. Obviously, if you look at the book, then it's not so short living, but print media and in particular radio, television are rather short living. Now, if we use the Facebook and Twitter possibilities, or generally social network possibilities. We increasingly make public a lot of personal information, and these data, images, and messages stay available virtually for an unlimited period of time. In this connection, the right to be forgotten plays a role. This was the topic of my contribution in the book. Therefore, I'm not going to look into that anymore. Apart from the changes in the technology, I would also like to shed some light on the political powers in the digital age. Since 1648, the Westphalian Peace Treaty, we are living with the political framework of sovereignty. In other words, based on the territoriality principle, each state is responsible for the legal environment within its territories. During centuries, international treaty making was a domain of state power. However, the globalization by way of the internet has obviously led to a loss of the nation state's sovereignty. On the one hand, important private organizations started to play an important role, in particular the ICANN with the root server system and the protocol system, and finally the domain names, but also generally the businesses and private persons were more interested to communicate in a cross-border way, and as a consequence, the traditional sovereignty principle has been undermined, and I may refer to a statement made at the end of the 20th century by the then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who expressed the opinion that a global era would require global engagement and that necessary actions in favor of humanity could not embark on the basis of the traditional approach looking at sovereignty. As I mentioned in the context of the governance of the global infrastructure, in particular the internet, new necessities have arisen, in particular the multi-stakeholder concept, which was first mentioned at the second summit of the World Society of the Information, World Summit on the Information Society in Tunis. The respective Tunis agenda was referring to the roles and responsibilities of various stakeholders, such as governments, the commercial world, civil society, and the academic technical community. All of a sudden, at least four major stakeholders are mentioned, and these four major stakeholders should be responsible for designing governance structures. States are only one out of the four stakeholders. And if we look at internet governance, we have to keep in mind that the rules on internet governance do have an impact on media governance rules, since the two elements are interlinked. And the question is, of course, to what extent the other three stakeholders, which I mentioned, civil society, businesses, and academia, could really assume the respective responsibilities. Multi-stakeholder approach is something which has been applied at certain occasions, in particular during the Net Mundial of April 2014 in Sao Paulo, giving representatives of civil society exactly the same rights as diplomats. However, at least in the important conferences on the international level, we still see that nation states are playing the predominant roles, in particular at the World Conference on International Telecommunications, the so-called WIGIT, which has been held in Dubai in December 2012. And we have seen another element which is not unimportant in my opinion. We have seen something like a revival of the sovereignty thoughts by certain countries, mainly autocratically governed countries such as Russia, China, but also many Arab countries, who and the representatives of these countries pleaded for having a retransfer of competencies from an international body, be it ICANN, be it the IETF, the Technical Organization for Internet Regulation, to the state level. Now, based on this foundation and having a regard to the technological and political environment, the design of a new media governance project would have to be taken at hand. And very obviously, first of all, we have to look at the tensions between technology and regulatory efforts by international or national bodies. If we look at the literature, we have seen the notion of technology as a regulation for quite some time. It goes back to the German legal sociologist Niklas Luhmann, has then been taken up by Lawrence Lessig in the United States. And the message is that architecture is based on the code being described as the design of the hardware and the software elements for the network, as well as of the communication elements allowing these other hardware and software components to interact with each other. The constraints of the code are self-executing and apply without specific intervention from the participants. In other words, designing cyberspace through software code is becoming a powerful regulatory activity. And the subsequent question is, of course, to what extent this role can be left to the technicians or to the businesses, or whether state intervention would be desirable and should be taken into account. There are a couple of questions which must be tackled. How much state regulation is necessary to secure collective values in the given technical architecture? Can society accept the aggregation of individual preferences? Thirdly, are choices among architectures necessarily political, making collective decision-making imperative? And fourth point, can code or architecture be established as a semi-autonomous, semi-distinct social domain? And these questions can be practically elaborated on the basis of certain developments which we have seen during the last couple of years, developments which show that technology can be an enforcement tool. The first one is obviously internet filtering or censorship. We can realize that states are in a position to apply different measures apart from the traditional blocking and filtering. It is possible to take down information from the internet or to build a pervasive culture of self-censorship, preventing unsuitable content from being created and published online. And these developments have not decreased over the last few years, but rather increased. Notwithstanding more sophisticated applications, internet filtering remains a relatively old technology, particularly if compared to code and architecture. So from a technological perspective, internet filtering is less a modality of control than a tool of identification and selection. Insofar, a major problem consists in the fact that such governmental intervention is not transparent. Another way of interfering with communication can be seen in the digital rights management. Originally, digital rights management systems were a measure to strengthen copyright protection. The entertainment industry attempted to avoid illegal downloading of music and films by wrapping digital content into a technologically protected package. Later on, digital rights managements have also tried to regulate access to information, and this is obviously more problematic. In other words, such kind of practice jeopardizes the openness of the internet infrastructure and systems somehow controlled by governments or states or by private businesses could decide over the possible communications flow. And my last part looks now at the possible new elements which should be taken into account for the design of a modern media governance framework. I think after all what I have said, in the interest of time, I'm not going to justify any more in detail why, in my opinion, it is necessary to have a new media governance framework, particularly a framework which takes into account the globalization of the communications. If such kind of framework is designed, then the openness principles must be recognized as a major pillar of the respective framework. The bridges between sender and receiver of communications are the networks. Freedom and power are affected by the degree of their openness, by the extent to which individuals can bob and weave between networks to achieve their designed behavior, perceptions, and outcomes. And about a year ago, the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, has proposed to implement a new Magna Carta 800 years after the first Magna Carta in order to protect and enshrine the independence of cyberspace as means for communications exchanges, since the web he had created 15 years ago has become under increasing attack from governments and corporate influence, and he called his idea the realization of an open, neutral system. Third point, as far as technology is concerned, we need to have interoperability and neutrality. Technological interoperability and neutrality are notions that relate to infrastructure, not to media services, in a substantive understanding. However, if the infrastructure is not freely accessible for all members of civil society, the respective restrictions will have a negative impact on the viability of the media landscape. In particular, rules promoting technology neutrality should attempt to achieve a functional equivalence between different modes of activities and the non-discrimination between technologies with equivalent effects. Furthermore, and here we are coming now closer to media, a special design should be developed for the information intermediaries, because the information intermediaries do have a gatekeeper role. I may just refer to the EU inquirers into the behavior of Google. As far as their liability and responsibility is concerned, we are confronted with problems of conflicts of law, be it substantive law, be it jurisdiction. Some further presentations will dig more into these aspects. A fifth pillar of the framework should look at the content requirements. That's most likely the most difficult part of the exercise, because culture depends on the given environment. The same is true for moral, and security is always invoked if somebody wants to have a specific national rule to be implemented governing the media landscape. And if we look at this term security from a legal point of view, we immediately realize that it can have a narrow meaning or it can have a broad meaning. At the Wikit in Dubai. Some countries were arguing security is just the functioning of the network. Other representatives of some countries were arguing security is somehow the well-being of a society. So here we are entering a very critical area. And finally, we always have legitimacy issues. Those who regulate have to be active on the basis of some kind of democratic appointment, even in a multi-stakeholder regime, and these people should also be accountable for their activities. Thank you very much for your attention. I know that perhaps I have tried to transport a lot of rather theoretical thoughts, but hopefully you will have the chance to discuss them further during this highly interesting conference. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.